Julius Caesar reportedly said, "Language is a powerful weapon, and in the hands of a skilled person, it can be used to manipulate others." The British writer George Orwell, in his famous book 1984, describes how the authorities used language to manipulate the population. He called this process news speak. For example, joy camp replaced the word labor camp. Department of Peace replaced Department of War. The government agency that kept the truth from the people was called the Department of Truth. Government mottos were war is peace, freedom is slavery, and ignorance is strength. Well, we might think that this kind of language-twisting grammatical gymnastics is true only in dystopian novels, but it's far more common in our society than we might like to admit. Some use language in the abortion debate to manipulate beliefs and behaviors. Well, today we are observing Sanctity of Life Sunday. Every year about this time I speak on the issue of abortion because it is an important one, and I want to keep it on the front burner, or at least in the minds of our people. Back in 1973, the Supreme Court issued a decision in the infamous Roe v. Wade case that made abortion legal in all 50 states. Every year on the anniversary of this date, we celebrate the sanctity of human life in response to the culture of death. Today, I'd like to consider the language that the two sides use in this debate. And the language that we use is very important. Language reflects beliefs. Either you believe that that baby in the womb is a valuable human being worthy of support and protection, or you don't. Human life is either sacred or it's not sacred. There's really not much middle ground on this issue. People on one side of the debate use the language that upholds the idea that the pre-born baby is a real human being, made in the image of God, and having basic human rights. People on the other side of the debate use language demonstrating that they believe that the pre-born baby has no rights and no value. That's what they believe, and their language, the language that they employ in this debate, shows their attitude. So let's consider then this morning the two sides of this debate and the language that they use. First of all, the pro-abortion side uses language like pro-abortion or pro-choice versus words like anti-abortion or pro-life or perhaps right to life. Shortly after the Supreme Court decision, Roe v. Wade, back in 1973, those opposed to abortion adopted the term pro-life instead of anti-abortion. Supporters of abortion, of course, call themselves pro-choice. Now, the words pro-choice implies that it's the mother's choice whether she will keep her baby or abort it. This decision focuses on the rights of the mother. She has the right to make the choice regarding whether her baby will live or die. Pro-life implies that the baby is a human being even before it is born. That baby is a human and worthy of protection. This description focuses on the rights of the baby, that it has the right to life. Today, most news outlets use the term anti-choice or anti-abortion rights instead of pro-life to describe those who are against abortion. Those who are for abortion believe in abortion rights or perhaps reproductive freedom. Those against abortion are described as anti-rights. Pro-choice people are usually called pro-abortion rights or pro-reproductive health care. But no matter how they describe it, we know that many people are proudly pro-abortion. Many abortion supporters are very bold in their proclamation that abortion is actually a good thing. Women today shout their abortion. They want to publicize it. They want everybody to know that they've had one. They gladly tell others how happy they are to have had an abortion. They claim abortion is a constitutional right, and they see it as a positive good for society. Further, many people make a lot of money from abortions. I think really that's the main reason today that abortion is still legal, is that it's a very lucrative industry. Abortion doctors, nurses, and executives make millions of dollars from the abortion procedures. Political candidates receive millions from the abortion industry. Medical research makes millions from abortion. So pro-abortion is a good term that describes an awful lot of people in our world today because they make a lot of money from the practice. By the way, abortion leader Planned Parenthood donated $45 million to the campaign to re-elect President Biden. They no doubt expect a big return on their investment, and already President Biden has started paying them back for their big investment in his campaign. So pro-abortion, I think, is a very accurate way to describe many people and organizations in our world today. Let's consider then also the words fetus or products of conception or tissue or potential life versus the word baby. Scientists tell us that at the earliest stages of human life, that initial multi-celled organism is called a zygote. After a little bit more growth, it's usually called a fetus or an embryo. Anybody who values that little organism in the womb calls it a baby. But the New York Times editorial board recently used the phrase cluster of cells that have not yet developed into viable human beings in a discussion of rights extended to the fetus in the womb. They don't even want to call the baby a fetus or an embryo. They want to call it a cluster of cells that have not yet developed into a viable human being. Well, they're not the only ones using that kind of verbal gymnastics to refer to the baby. National Public Radio recently published this policy statement regarding how to report about this issue. This is a quote from the NPR piece. They said, the term unborn implies that there's a baby inside a pregnant woman, not a fetus. Babies are not babies until they're born. Did you know that? That you really shouldn't call it a baby until it's born? Well, that's what NPR believes. Now, NPR is supposed to be reporters of the news, reporters of the facts, but this is clearly an opinion to say that the baby is not a baby until it's born. Says who? Who says that? A lot of people refer to that baby in the womb as a baby before it's born, but not NPR. They go on to say those things in the womb are fetuses. Incorrectly calling a fetus a baby or the unborn is part of the strategy used by anti-abortion groups to shift the language, the legality, and public opinion on this issue. Well, I would say that referring to that baby as a fetus or an embryo or a clump of cells or disposable tissue is a way that NPR and others in society, the language that they use to try to support their idea that the baby is nothing and can be easily disposed of. Well, when you go to the obstetrician and talk to the doctor about what's in the womb of the woman, it's usually called a baby. Friends and family have a baby shower. The mother shows a baby bump. The mother is with child, not with a clump of cells. When a surgery is performed on that pre-born baby to save the baby's life or to help the baby to overcome some injury or disease, that baby in the womb is still called a baby, not a clump of cells, not an embryo. The problem is that cluster of cells is actually a human being. That cluster of cells has everything necessary to develop into a normal, regular human. All it lacks is growth and development. Have you heard of or do you know what a snowflake baby is? A snowflake baby is the word that they use to describe an embryo produced through in vitro fertilization that has been frozen for later use. Now, if you don't know what in vitro fertilization is, you can look that up on your own. I'm not going to describe that process, but some couples try to have a baby through the process of in vitro fertilization, and with the extra materials that is created, they usually freeze them for later use. Well, recently, a snowflake baby was implanted into the womb of a woman and then was born 9 months later. This supposed cluster of cells had been conceived through IVF almost 27 years ago. The embryo was frozen back in October of 1992. The woman who received this frozen embryo was 29. And so there's only 18 months of difference between the true age of the mother and the age of her daughter. This birth holds the record for the longest frozen embryo known to have resulted in a live birth. So that cluster of cells that has been in suspension, that's been frozen over these 27 years, what is that? Well, it's a human. It was implanted in the womb of a woman, and 9 months later she gave birth to a baby. So if it's not human, what in the world is it? When Planned Parenthood wants to use the pieces of an aborted baby, why do they think that those pieces have value? Why do they sell them to medical researchers? It's because those pieces are human. They have value because what is in the womb of the woman developing and growing is a human being. It can't be anything else. Let's now look at the words terminate the pregnancy versus kill or murder. Pro-abortion people, frankly, don't want us to think about what happens in an abortion. Frankly, I'd rather not think about it either. I know what goes on in an abortion, and frankly, I really don't want to think about that at all. Abortions are grisly, barbaric, and violent procedures that result in the painful death of a human being. But those who support the practice don't want to admit that. They're not killing a person, they claim. They're merely terminating a pregnancy. They claim it's like removing an appendix or a bad tooth. It's a simple procedure to get rid of something you don't want. It's relatively cheap, quick, and clean. It's really no big deal. That's what they want us to think. But we should call abortion what it really is. It is murder. It's the taking of the life of an innocent person. And frankly, there is no more innocent person than a pre-born baby. If it's not murder in red blood, frankly, I don't know what it is. Let's go on to look at some other language here. How about parasite or foreign substance or leech or alien versus baby? The more stridently pro-abortion one is, the more likely it is that one will refer to the unborn baby as a parasite, a foreigner, an alien, or even as a leech. This invader occupies the body of the mother without asking permission and causes all sorts of inconveniences. If the woman does not want to be inconvenienced, or frankly for any other reason, she has the legal right to remove the unwanted intruder from her body. They say that the baby is not natural. It's a foreigner. It's an alien. But the Bible calls the baby bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. Babies are produced through a natural process that most women understand fairly well. In the vast majority of cases, women cooperate in the creation of a baby. Well, if you want to dehumanize that baby, what do? You call it foreign. You call it unnatural. You call it unhealthy. It's like a leech or a parasite. You can't have any sympathy or compassion for that thing, so you think of it as an alien substance. But is it really alien? Is it unnatural? Well, of course it's not. That baby is utterly natural and absolutely human, and that's why killing it is murder. How about the words bondage or disease versus pregnancy? Some women today describe pregnancy as a disease or as bondage. They see it as an illness that they want to come to an end. They feel like they are entrapped or contaminated by the baby's gestation. I think that we would all agree that pregnancy for some women is a very difficult time. The presence of the baby in the womb does all sorts of inconvenient things to the woman's body. Some women seem to thrive during pregnancy, but others find it very difficult. Once that baby is born, the bulk of the care for the baby generally falls to the woman, especially if she's a single mother. We can understand why some women might not want to have a baby at a particular time in life, especially if they don't want to dedicate themselves to the care and feeding of that child. Is there anything a woman can do to avoid the inconvenience and pain of pregnancy? Well, yes. If a woman chooses to avoid certain behaviors, then it's highly unlikely that she'll experience pregnancy. If she voluntarily engages in certain behaviors, well, then she should expect the natural results of her behavior to occur. Preventing pregnancy is not rocket science. Most adults know how the whole thing works. But once that child is in the womb, every ethical and moral instinct should tell the mother that she is absolutely obligated to care for her own baby. It's an unnatural sentiment that moves the woman to rid herself of her own flesh and blood. Abortion is unnatural in just about every way conceivable. How about the words reproductive rights versus responsibilities and obligations? Much of the debate really boils down to rights versus responsibilities. Does the mother have the right to be not pregnant if she doesn't want to be pregnant? Or is she expected to care for that baby that she helped to create? Once the baby exists in the womb, what has more authority? Is it the rights of the mother or the rights of the baby? Pro-abortionists, of course, believe that the rights of the mother trump the rights of the baby. Some of them, in fact, will even admit that that creature, that cluster of cells in the womb, actually is a human being, but it's a person with no rights. They'll say, well, obviously science tells us very clearly that that little creature in the womb has to be a human. It has DNA, it has its own set of processes and its own body and its own systems, and it's all working like an independent human being. So we can't deny that that's what it is, but the preborn baby is a person with no rights, they will tell us. Maybe it is a real person, but it's not covered by any constitutional rights. If that argument sounds familiar, it is, or it should be, because it's the same argument used by the Nazis in World War II to dehumanize the Jews, to give them the reason to kill them also. If the baby is human, and everything we know about that pre-born little baby demonstrates that it is human, if it is, then it has just as many rights as the mother does. It's only when you dehumanize the baby that you can deny its natural rights. So should a mother be able to avoid the responsibilities when she creates a baby? If she becomes pregnant, is she obligated to carry that baby to birth? Or if she doesn't want the baby, does she have the right just to get rid of it? I believe that once that baby is conceived, the mother has the obligation to take care of it. If she didn't want to be pregnant, well, she could have taken certain steps that would be necessary to prevent the creation of that baby. Once the baby makes its appearance, the mother and the father, I believe, are obligated to care for it. If they can't care for it, then they should give it up to somebody who would like to care for it. In fact, we know that there are lines of people waiting to get babies to care for. And so if a mother decides that she doesn't want that baby, there are other avenues other than abortion. Let's talk then about reproductive health care versus murder. Many of those who support abortion really don't like to use the word abortion. That word conjures up all kinds of unpleasant pictures. So they come up with alternative phrases like reproductive health care. Doesn't that sound positive and clean? You know, she's not getting an abortion, she's getting health care. Planned Parenthood doesn't provide abortions, it provides health care. It sounds so caring and so positive. But in the case of abortion, what's health care supposedly for the woman is death for the baby. What about the baby's health care? How do you call the dismemberment of a perfectly healthy pre-born child health care? It's an example of newspeak, like I talked about earlier. It's the manipulation of the language that hinders people understanding the truth. The truth is that the pro-abortion people don't care about that baby at all. They really should not call it health care because they don't care about the baby. The baby is disposable. If nobody wants that baby, well, then let's just get rid of it. It has no value. So pro-abortion people really ought to be honest with what they think. There's no way that abortion should be called or described as health care. It's the exact opposite of care. Abortion happens when the mother and the doctor don't care about that baby. How about the words embryonic pulsing versus fetal heartbeat? One of the most exciting events for new parents is when they go to the doctor and they're able to hear the heartbeat of their baby for the very first time. It's often a very emotional experience when the parents hear that swoosh, swoosh sound of that tiny beating heart. But I read one article that claimed that that swoosh, swoosh sound really is just an electrical impulse. It's not really the tiny beating heart of that baby. It's just an electrical impulse that may sometime in the future become a heartbeat. Well, simple observation tells us that the baby's heart begins beating at about 6 or 7 weeks of gestation. And in fact, at 10 weeks, that heart is fully developed and it's functioning just like it does in adults. But the pro-abortion people tell us that it's not really a heartbeat. It's just an electrical impulse. Well, the problem is that you really can't hear electrical impulses, normally speaking. There are electrical impulses flowing around us all the time, through the wires in the walls, through the lights, through the radio signals. Do you hear those electrical impulses? Not usually. What that swoosh, swoosh is the beating of the baby's heart. It's not just electrical impulses. Pro-life legislators have introduced bills in many states stipulating that abortion should be illegal after that baby's heartbeat begins. I think all abortions should be outlawed, but this at least is a step in the right direction. If the baby has a heartbeat, it should be illegal to kill it. What about the words want versus need? News accounts often speak of a woman needing an abortion. Why does she need an abortion? Well, in the vast majority of cases, she needs an abortion because she doesn't want the baby. It's not that her life is in danger or that she'll suffer irreparable harm if she has the baby. She just doesn't want it. A baby will be inconvenient, painful, and expensive. In many cases, the woman seeking the abortion is not married. She has no other means of support other than herself, and because she has no husband, and perhaps not even parents who will help her, she is unable to take care of that baby for herself. So if the woman has any reason not to want the baby, well then all of a sudden she needs to have an abortion, supposedly. Well, need and want, of course, are two different concepts, two different words with two different meanings. In only a very small minority of cases does a woman actually need to have an abortion. And only in those very rare cases when the baby must be aborted to save the life of the mother should we refer to that as the need to take the life of that baby. For example, in an ectopic pregnancy, the embryo has implanted in the wrong place and it has no chance of survival. In that case, they have to. The doctor basically has to take the life of that little baby because it will die no matter what, and if it's allowed to continue, it may endanger the life of the mother. But that, again, is a very rare occasion, and situations in which pregnancy actually threatens the life of the mother are very rare. With advances in medicine and neonatal care, it's almost never necessary to choose between the life of the baby and the life of the mother. When it's absolutely necessary to take the life of the baby in order to save the life of the mother, it's not the same as a voluntary abortion. Also, many people say that abortion should be ethically acceptable in the cases of rape or incest. Well, I disagree with that as well. Two wrongs don't make a right. The baby is not guilty and does not deserve to die no matter how it was created. The best way for good to come out of that kind of bad situation would be to allow the baby to be born and give it up for adoption to a loving and caring household if the mother does not want it. And finally, what about the words good versus evil, or evil versus good? Ultimately, the abortion is a matter of evil versus good, sinfulness versus righteousness, and rebellion versus obedience. Those who have any kind of commitment to the God of the Bible recognize that abortion is murder, and of course, murder is a great sin. Those who participate in abortion, especially those who facilitate it or do the procedures, frankly, are especially evil, wicked people. They are involved in a heinous sin. They're shedding innocent blood, something that God hates. They're guilty of mass murder, and they will face severe, just, and eternal punishment for that. Can you be a good person and support abortion? No, you can't. Not if you understand what abortion is. Now, I suppose, hypothetically, there may be some young person who really doesn't know what abortion does. Perhaps there are some who have been told over and over again that abortion is not murder, that that thing growing in the womb is just a clump of cells. They don't truly understand what abortion is, that it's taking the life of an innocent human being. So perhaps there are some who don't know any better. But by and large, most people understand the process and they recognize that you're taking the life of that innocent baby. If you know what abortion is and you support or participate in any way, then you are an evil, wicked person. There is no other way around that. Are there good people on both sides of this issue? Sometimes we discuss various issues and we say, well, there are good people on both sides. They disagree, they hold different opinions, but ultimately there are good people on both sides of the issue. Well, I don't believe there are good people on both sides of this issue. There's only one good side of this debate, and that's the pro-life side. The other side is pro-death, and they are promoting a culture of death. This is a clear-cut black and white issue, and all Christians of every stripe ought to be on the right side of it, and that's the pro-life side. Julius Caesar was right when he said language is a powerful weapon that can be used to manipulate others. Pro-abortionists use language that manipulates ignorant people into thinking that abortion is healthcare and a constitutional right when it is neither. It's not healthcare in any regard, and it's certainly not a constitutional right. Pro-abortionists are guilty of newspeak. They want to use language that dehumanizes that unborn baby and hides the truth of what abortion really is. They repeat the lie loudly enough and frequently enough, and many people believe it. They have been largely successful in persuading about half of the population that abortion is a good thing. Pro-life supporters use language that reveals the true value of unborn humans, as well as the nature of abortion. Pro-life supporters promote the culture of life. They believe that the baby in the womb is a human life, worthy of protection and care. That baby has the right to life. Abortion is murder, plain and simple. Those who participate in abortion are murderers, as are those who support it or profit from it. Well, telling the truth about abortion is very offensive these days. Perhaps the government will at some point label such language as hate speech. They may try to shut us down for saying things like I've just said. But until they do, we must be bold in proclaiming that abortion is terribly unjust, barbaric, and ungodly. Those who participate in it or who support it commit the gravest of sins and are liable to strict and eternal judgment. No manipulative language can change that fact. Well, let's pray.